You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 31st, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Manisa McCleave Maharaval and Zoltan Gluck to CUNY grads who interviewed some protesters up in Montreal, Quebec, find out, at least get some insight as to what is going on up there and why. Also on the program today, a special added bonus, Dave Hill, to finish what we started last Friday and were so rudely interrupted with his tasteful nudes. Also today, Scott Walker, drip, 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 drip. If he's lucky, the dam won't break before his recall election. New York Times comes out against the secret kill list. New York City, in a devastating blow to Matt here in the office, bans large sugary drinks. And first off, let me just note that today is the third anniversary of the killing, the murder of George Tiller, who was a doctor in Kansas, who was murdered because he provided abortions to women. And my understanding is that after a couple of years, there was an attempt by another doctor to come in state and occasionally provide those services, and she suffered enormous harassment and threats, and I'm not sure that she's actually able to maintain that practice. But lest you forget that we do have essentially, I mean, I don't know what could be considered terrorism if the idea of killing one person, of assassinating one person to send a message to others is not considered terrorism, I don't know what is. I just wanted to note that. On a happier note, good news out of Boston, ladies and gentlemen. The Defense of Marriage Act, which was instituted in 1996 in response to a fear amongst bigots and those, and I guess our House and Senate at the time, and our president, who I believe signed the law, that would be Bill Clinton. When it appeared that Hawaii would legalize gay marriage, the Defense of Marriage Act was instituted, which basically said the federal government will not recognize any marriage that takes place between two people of the same sex in any state in terms of providing them with the legal rights and benefits that the federal government provides for any other married couple. And today, or I should say, yes, today in Boston, the U.S. First Circuit Court of Appeals, or rather the First U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, ruled the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, unconstitutional. The appeals court agreed with a lower court judge who ruled in 2010 that the law is unconstitutional because it interferes with the right of a state to define marriage and denies married gay couples federal benefits given to heterosexual couples. The most pertinent graph of the decision, and the decision was written, I believe, two of the three judges are Republicans. The decision was written by Mike Bowden, who was appointed by George Bush the Elder and was apparently a deputy assistant attorney general under the Reagan administration. He wrote, to conclude, many Americans believe that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, and most Americans live in states where that is the law today. One virtue of federalism is that it permits this diversity of governance based on local choice, but this applies as well to the states that have chosen to legalize same-sex marriage. Under current Supreme Court authority, Congress's denial of federal benefits to same-sex couples lawfully married in Massachusetts has not been adequately supported by any permissible federal interest. In other words, the federal government does not have any interest that allows it to overrule the finding of a particular state in this matter. And you should note that House Speaker John Boehner, paid for, or not personally, but with our taxpayer dollars, paid to defend DOMA in this court. The Obama administration last year announced that the Department of Justice would no longer defend DOMA. Got a question on Twitter from listener Lucia. Why has it taken so many years for this to happen? And my guess is, you can't really start counting from 96. What you need to start counting is from 2004 when Massachusetts passed gay marriage or found it to be constitutional within that state. I think you needed a state to argue that DOMA was unconstitutional. You needed actually gay marriage to be legal somewhere before someone could bring this case about the overreach by the federal government. I got to check on that, but that would be my guess. So this will head to the Supreme Court. I don't know when, but soon enough, folks. And I think it's just probably a matter of time before DOMA is struck down. Unless, of course, the five, particularly Scalia and Thomas, Roberts and Alito, decide that they're not really going to pay attention to what they usually rule and just throw a bone, as it were, to their rabid right-wing base. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Manisa McCleave Maharaval and Zoltan Gluck on what's happening in Montreal. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Zoltan Gluck pursuing a doctorate in anthropology at the CUNY Graduate Center, and Manisa Maharwaval, a graduate student at CUNY Graduate Center, a writer and activist. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
And I should also mention that both of you wrote pieces that appeared in Occupy, Scenes from Occupied America.
That's correct.
Yeah.
All right. So you wrote a piece at wagingnonviolence.org. Manisa, tell me how long you were up in Montreal. What got you up there?
Sure. We went up to Montreal last week. It was actually sort of one of these split decisions where we had a friend who's going up and he said, come up with us. There are these huge protests happening. I've been hearing about them for months and was actually feeling a little stir crazy in New York and wanted to go up to Montreal and sort of see what was happening on the streets there. And so less than like a few hours after a friend mentioned it, we were on a train at 8 a.m. the next morning going up to Montreal. We were there for about 4 days, I think. So.
And Zoltan, who did you have a chance to speak with?
Well, we were staying with a couple of friends of ours friends of friends, actually, student organizers, student union organizers from McGill and the University of Montreal. And, they're just kind of acquaintances through the network of student organizers here in New York City. People have been going back and forth to Montreal, and so that type of connection has been established. And so we went up and ended up staying with some really awesome folks, actually. Had a really, really interesting time speaking with them, marching with them, banging on pots and pans.
Okay, yeah, I want to get to the pots and pans, because that's an interesting element of this. But, Manisa, just give us some backstory on this. I think there's many of our listeners who have a vague awareness of what's going on up there, but this is the longest continuous student protest, I believe, in this in North America's history.
Yeah, that's right. So the students voted to go on strike. So the students are organized in student unions sort of on a provincial level and then on a university level. And they sort of collectively voted university by university to go on strike in, I think it was February 14th that they first decided to go on strike. And so have been on strike for over 100 days now. Which is just huge. Basically, the university had to end up, the provincial government actually had to end up canceling the semester, ending classes early, and starting the semester in the fall early as well to compensate for the time they've lost. So it's had a huge impact on the semester. And the students voted to go on strike because of tuition hikes that the government's trying to impose on the public universities there over the next 3 years.
And Zoltan, when we talk about student unions, I think in this country, when we talk about student unions, we talk about the place where students go and hang out and maybe get there's a snack bar and people play video games. But in fact, there are actual student organizations when we talk about student unions?
Yeah, the student unions have a lot of actual power. I mean, these student union representatives sit on the education boards, both at the university level as well as at the city level, the provincial level. They've shown that power repeatedly. This is not the first strike that the student unions have put on. The reason why the tuition is lower in Quebec than the rest of Canada is because the student unions are able to muster a tremendous amount of support from students at a very broad level. They've put a huge amount of pressure on the administrations in Canada since the 1960s and have effectively prevented tuition from going up in Quebec over the last, I mean, 50 years, really. It's been pretty amazing. The last major strike was in 2005. Which is actually quite important for understanding the dynamics of this strike now. Then they went on strike. one of the unions ended up striking a deal with the government, and so the united front of the strike ended up breaking, and there were some concessions made at that point in 2005, and some of the other unions were quite upset with the way in which it played out. Some people were enfranchised, other people were left out. This time around, on the other hand, there's been a totally united front across the board, across the student unions, and they've managed to keep the unified strike going for 9 days. So, the largest protest so far was on May 22nd. They had estimated anywhere between 300,000 and 400,000 people on the streets, just to give you an idea of the type of scale that we're talking about here.
300,000, 400,000 people. And, Manissa, on a daily basis, there's consistent protesters in the street. Isn't that right?
Yeah, so every night at 8:30, and they've been doing this for months now, people meet up, and I think they say the daily, nightly protests are smaller, clearly, but they're between, when we were there, they said the average was 3,000 people, we were at one that was 5,000 through 10,000 people, so these are still thousands of people on the streets every night. But nightly they meet up around 8:30 in the center of the city and sort of go on a march, and the march is unplanned, and no one knows where it's going to go, and they sort of march around, and they get real, I think what was amazing was seeing how much neighborhood support they had. Your people out their windows banging pots and on, getting on the streets with them. And what's been happening more recently is that in neighborhoods, people will start protesting in their neighborhoods, like taking over an intersection, and then they will start marching and join up with this larger march. So it's sort of, you get the feeling that it's every night, it's all over the city, it's sort of an event that happens, you know, and everyone's excited about it. And, you know, at 8 o'clock, everyone starts banging their pots and pans, 8:30, everyone starts marching. By 10 o'clock, there's a huge march with thousands of people walking through the city. It feels really joyful. It was really inspiring. The energy was really amazing.
Yeah, well, one of the things you touch upon in your piece, Manissa, is this notion that the groundwork for these protests has been laid for the past couple of years, where these students have been going out into the communities and educating them. And I think at one point someone spoke about opening up a certain amount of space to converse. Talk about that a little bit, because I think, you know, as we talk about this and we look at any type of parallels or any type of lessons for the Occupy movement, this seems to be a very interesting element.
Yeah, definitely. I think when we were up there and just feeling the energy and being amazed at how many people were on the streets all the time, I kept asking the organizers that we were with, how did this happen? How did you get thousands of people on the streets? And they're like, you know, there's no secret, you know, we've been working on this for years. And I think that was just a really important moment for me. I feel like as an activist, I get sort of impatient often. And it was really important for me to hear, like, we've been working on this for years. We've been standing on corners. We've been talking to our colleagues. We've been handing out flyers. We've been having discussions in our student unions for years now. I mean, really since 2005. But more recently, in the past 2 years, we've known that these tuition hikes are coming, and they've been trying to work really hard to build popular support against them. And I think the part of building that popular support is connecting the tuition hikes to things like increased debt, to things like austerity policies in Quebec and in Canada generally. So sort of saying, like, this is about tuition hikes, but it's actually about issues that affect everyone in society. So.
And Zoltan, another part of this, of course, has to do with the notion of Quebec nationalism. And you mentioned that you were staying with McGill University organizers, as well as I mentioned that because McGill is an English speaking school, and I'm curious as to what extent McGill has been students have been involved, as opposed to students from the French-speaking university, and where, you know, how does that divide play out?
Right. Well, from what I understand, yes, McGill students have been significantly less involved than the other Francophone university in Montreal and across Quebec, this has to do, from what we understood from some of the organizers, and these were McGill organizers, these were Francophone McGill organizers who have been involved with various unions for the last few years and have been trying to organize at McGill and are involved in organizing some of the other universities as well, is that by their account, McGill is the most elite university in Quebec. It is predominantly Anglophone. It's more conservative, and which goes along with it being a more elite institution. And there's been a lot less support for the protesting of student strikes. The Francophone universities have been really the hotbed of organizing, have been the places where there's more student radicalism, where there's more successful outreach being done, and where the kind of vote for the strike really came from. And this plays into a longer history. I think, I mean, all of these struggles need to be really thought of in terms of the space of being put out through them. You could say the same thing about the struggles of opportunity, of course. Maybe that's something we can get back to later. But the particular history at play here is, I mean, the tendencies in Quebec for wanting more autonomy, wanting secession at the level of the French community in Quebec, and feeling a general level of kind of oppression coming down from the broader Anglophone country that is Canada, and the kind of subordination of the French population in Quebec. So there is definitely a working class and nationalist flavor to some of the student protests that is really important to understand, but is also kind of not very well understood. And I think that goes into a longer history of the relationship between the French population in Quebec and the broader country of Canada, and a feeling of a type of working class identity of the Quebec Francophone community vis-a-vis a more elite ruling class, if you will,
Anglophone
community in Quebec.
And my sense is, and I don't know which one of you can speak to this more, Manissa, if... what can you tell me about Bill 78? Because my understanding is not only Bill 78 was essentially the legislation passed or to quash essentially protest in this country, and or I should say in Quebec, and it was incredibly, I guess, damaging for the politicians who supported it, and generated a lot more protest.
Yeah, so since Bill 78 has passed, the protests have grown, right? And this is another way that people have been like sort of seeing the connections between, you know, increasing tuition and protests against increasing tuition and the suppression of dissent. Right? And so Bill 78 was a direct attack on the freedom of assembly and the right to protest in Quebec. It makes it so that you can't have an unpermitted march or an unpermitted gathering of more than 50 people. And it also has these huge fines against student unions, against organizers, directly targeting student leaders and union organizers who would be planning these things, levying thousands of dollars of fines against them. And also sort of saying that you have to give the police your march route 24 hours in advance, and just sort of really directly attacking the way that the students have been on the streets every night, sort of taking the streets on these sort of joyful impromptu marches and saying you can't do that anymore. And I think the response has been that people have really been like, oh, wait, if they can pass a special law like this, it's a special law, right? If they can pass a special law like this just to suppress the student movement, right, what does that mean for all of our civil liberties? And so people have really sort of taken this up, and sort of it's broadened the struggle in Montreal right now and in Quebec right now. A lot of the chants when you're on the streets are about student debt, but they're also against the law. And so when we were up there, actually, we saw the first time that they were actually using the law to have mass arrests. So they arrested 500 people at one of the nightly marches we're at. And it was really sort of out of nowhere. Everyone's marching along really peacefully, really joyfully. Suddenly you're surrounded by cops in riot gear on either side of you, and they're just arresting everyone in between them. And we'd been marching for hours, and it felt really random, right, and really repressive. And I think people in Montreal are really viewing this as not just about students anymore, but about everyone's right to protest, to assemble, to express dissent.
Zoltan, what happens next? I mean, what are the students obviously are specifically focused on rolling back this tuition hike. What is there a sense that that could possibly happen soon, or what are the organizers anticipating will happen over the next 2, 3, 4 weeks, or 2 or 3, 4 months? What is their timeline? What are they anticipating?
Yeah, that's really an important, interesting question. It was one that we kept on asking our friends and kind of acquaintances, student organizers up there. I think that, they're quite humble about the prospects of gaining immediate victories. And I think that's always a realistic position to take. But I think what we've seen over the last 2 weeks is, as Vanessa is referencing, a tremendous amount of support just coming out right now. I think there's a gambit that the Chartist government, that's the prime minister, really played with this special law, this state of exception law, this temporary law, which is highly repressive, really draconian, has completely failed, and it might resolve and they're having to make massive concessions, because while the student movement was kind of, from my understanding, in a bit of uncertain straits before the special law was passed, now the popular support has just exploded, and it doesn't really seem like it's going to die down over the summer. So, I mean, I think what student organizers are hoping is to carry momentum through the summer, which, I mean, as we know, student organizers is always the most difficult aspect. I mean, school gets out, people go away for the summer. There's not the same type of institutional structure, and it's hard to keep momentum going. They have economic disruptions planned for the summer. There's like massive festivals, there's massive events in Montreal over the summer, and to keep the pressure on the government to say, we're not going away, you can't just have business as normal, you need to take us seriously. I think they're planning on keeping these nightly protests going. They're planning on disrupting life as normal in Quebec, and I think what's amazing is that they have the support to do so from the broader population. So I think you can anticipate this thing sticking around for a while, and I mean, a victory in Quebec would be a victory for everyone. I think a victory, and everyone's looking there right now. They're kind of the vanguard of student struggles, at least in North America.
Is Zoltan, finally, do you, operationally speaking, do you think what lessons do you think the Occupy movement is taking from this?
Yeah, that's also a really difficult question to answer, but I think that people are explicitly looking to Quebec with that question in mind. This is a discussion that's going on at various levels, at different types of assemblies and various organizing groups. There's going to be an assembly this Sunday at Washington Square Park at noon, which is organized by various education-oriented Occupy working groups, that is going to be explicitly asking this question of what types of lessons we can learn from Quebec in terms of organizing around education here. Of course, it's really difficult to translate their organizing structures into U.S. context. As you've said, we don't have the same type of strong student unions. But there are some real important lessons. The one Vanessa said, like, that when they saw that these tuitions were going to come into place, these tuition hikes were going to come into place, they started organizing 2 years in advance, and that's really paid off for them. For example, we've had 35% tuition hikes over the next 5 years put into place last fall at CUNY. We organized a couple of months in advance. We really started organizing in the summer, and when the Board of Trustees meeting happened where they were going to be voting on this, we had a good few hundred people out. And that, I think, is like commensurate with a couple of months of organizing that we had. If we'd been putting in organizing a couple of years in advance, who would have really known what we could have accomplished? I think it's also important to remember that the police repression that happened after our protests of the tuition hikes on November 21st at CUNY, they arrested 15 students. A week later, about 3,000 people came out to show support. And that's the same type of pattern that's been happening in Quebec. So I think one of the things we can immediately learn is that trying to broaden the struggle, trying to organize in advance for things we see that are symptomatic of this new regime of austerity that's being applied all across the world right now, I think it's one of the major lessons we can learn. And trying to just speak with organizers about what types of tactics work in terms of pulling out people, what types of outreach tactics work, those types of things. But, I mean, this is an ongoing conversation. Again, it's going to be continued on Sunday at noon in a big public forum type of way. It's happening in private conversations all the time. So I think these are important things.
Manisa McLeave, yeah. Maharaval, and Zoltan Gluck, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. We'll put a link to your piece at majority.fm and as well to the book to which you contributed, Occupy Scenes from Occupied America. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. Boop, boop. Sorry about the connection at times during that interview. I think for the most part, it was fairly stable. And I think there is a another story here that involves the history of Quebec. And these things I must, you know, as any movements must be seen in with the backdrop of the history of the location that they're taking place, and the notion of an egalitarian Quebec has been well rooted there, I think, since about 1960 is my understanding, and I think a lot of what we're seeing here plays into that. I think the changes that we're seeing from the Quebec government in terms of increasing tuition there plays into a broader narrative of neoliberal changes, I think, that are happening in Quebec and how that relates to Canada. But interesting to see, to get at least a secondhand account of what the organizers are thinking there. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Dave Hill, who will give us his in-depth analysis of tasteful nudes. Yeah, that's right. We went from Quebec protests to Dave Hill. Upgrade, downgrade, you decide, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone is the the extremely elusive, apparently well sequestered, Dave Hill.
Yes.
Wow, it's not easy to get in touch with you. I called your place of employ, and first they wouldn't let me go through to you, and then they refused to connect me.
It's a nightmare, Sam.
What?
And this is... As maybe I told you last week, I got a job and it's awful.
Where are you working, NORAD?
I don't even know. I'm in some sort of bunker. I'm surrounded by drywall, sheetrock. I'm wearing one of those Geely suits. Do you know those things?
Geely what?
You know those things that makes it look like you're a tree?
Branches?
For, you know, for crime solving. Say like... You know, we're on a stakeout or something, and you need a man in the field, literally in the field, to lie down on the ground and appear to be, you know, grass and mulch and things like that. It's an outfit that you would wear. It's like camouflage, but
I've never heard anything like this. What does that got to do with a tree? If you're looking like grass and mulch, you're in a tree costume?
It's so you can, yeah, it's a tree costume. Didn't you ever watch To Catch a Predator?
What? What is that? Is that the one where they like the guy comes out and says, why did you try and go on Craigslist and get this 15-year-old girl?
Yeah, exactly. And then the guy's like, hey, you get on of here. And then the guy's like, okay, thanks. And he goes outside and he thinks he's off the hook. And then suddenly a guy in a Geely suit dressed as a tree jumps up from the ground or from behind a tree and tackles him. It's unnecessary, but it adds to the, you know, the drama.
Yeah, I guess I missed that part of it. Don't just cops just come out? I mean, I don't understand. Don't they come out of the garage or something?
No. Yeah, the predator in question will come out of the garage.
Now,
and then
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you if this is something that you learned by watching the show, or was this something that you learned firsthand?
I learned it from watching the hit TV show To Catch a Predator.
Okay.
Yeah, now in its seventh exhilarating year. I don't know what year it's in.
I have a feeling it's like its 15th year.
Yeah. As long as people are preying on other people, then, you know, they're in business.
Yeah, that's going to happen for a long time. Dave Hill, incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, is the author of The New Tasteful Nudes, which is actually I really quite like the cover.
Thank you.
I mean, I'm just looking at it now, and I'm just like, you know what? That's actually a very tasteful cover. You had Hodgman and Dick Cavett, Malcolm Gladwell. Look at all these people who Chris Elliott.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Are you friends with Chris Elliott?
Now, I mean, I'm friends with his daughter, Bridie, and that's how I met Chris.
Ah.
And but you know, we're not we don't have brunch or anything like that. I think, you know, we could get there.
Well, no, certainly I hope so. Tell us another story for you. Last week you told us about the Santa Claus thing, which was a story close to my heart, because I once went to a wedding dressed as a postal worker.
You did?
Yeah, it was a huge mistake.
Wait, now, this you is, just been let out of jail or something?
This is more for Name Drop Friday, but when Louis C.K. got married.
Oh, wow. You know Louis C.K.?
I do. Yeah.
I know Louis.
Well,
I don't know him. I don't know him well. I know him to say, hey, Louis. And he could say, hey, Dave, right?
Yeah, he's always very polite that way.
He is. He's a sweetheart.
So he, when he was getting married, now, I guess 13 years ago, he said that his now ex-wife wanted people to dress up for the wedding. And I'm like, well, what are we supposed to wear in the middle of July? It was in July. And he said, actually, you know, she doesn't want you to dress up like in fancy clothes, but, you know, dress up as like, you know, I don't know, in some type of costume or something. And I was like, oh, I got a postal outfit. And in my mind, I'm thinking, this is brilliant because it's short sleeves. It's shorts, and I'm going to be the coolest, not hippest, but literally the coolest. I'm going to be wearing a very lightweight outfit at the wedding. And
Yeah, but breathable cottons.
Exactly, and shorts.
Did you have a pith helmet, like the postal pith helmet?
What? Nobody wears a pith helmet anymore.
Where do you live with these
ghillie outfits and these pith helmets?
I live in an alternate universe. Where it's...
No, I had a baseball cap, I think. And
okay, so were you an actual postal worker?
No, but I had done a low budget TV show where we had a postal outfit, and so I kept it. And
oh wow!
Well, because you know how it is, Dave. I mean, you do this too, right? I mean.
Yeah, sure.
Your apartment is full of like wigs and
yeah, exactly.
Fake
yeah,
blood.
Fake Rasta wigs and dildos, basically.
Of course, and so the wedding was upstate. Just coincidentally, ended up not very far from where I ended up buying a house 5, 6, 7 years later. But
yeah, where
I went
you have
to
the.
I left the motel.
With animals.
Yeah, with the animals. And I left the motel and went to the wedding. It was outside in the back of their house. And I was the only person wearing anything other than, like, you know, a Friday dress casual stuff. And I still to this day cannot get Louis to tell me whether or not he was setting me up or what. And it was really... It was not a good situation. I ended up drinking too much, and then
I could see that.
Yeah, and some low budget filmmaker who had actually a lawyer who had represented my first film, which was on digital video, said we're starting a new company that's going to make these digital films for less than $100,000, and it's going to be great. We're going to make a slate of 10 of them a year, and I said terrific, sign me up. And he said. We're gonna need to have either a star or a named director do the film, and I just lost it on him because I was like, "You're destroying independent film. The whole point of low budget is so that you don't need that, and you're destroying it." And I'm yelling at him. I'm drunk, and I look over at the look on his wife's face, and she is horrified. And I realize I'm yelling at this guy. I'm drunk, and I'm in a postal outfit. At a wedding.
That's beautiful.
And I hear
you were sending him a message.
I was definitely sending him a message.
Right.
That was a special delivery, as it were.
Yeah, I got a special delivery.
And then I heard some other people at the wedding look at me and just go, "That must be one of Louis's comedy friends."
Well, wasn't it all comedy people probably, or were there regular folks?
I think there must have been some regular folks. They were, you know, mocking me, and but yeah, then there was a bunch of comedy folks. It was a day. It was one of the most depressing days of my life, I think.
Yeah, that sounds, I mean, I went to a wedding once thinking it was a good idea. A friend of mine had a full Scottish kilt sort of formal wear scenario, and I thought, that would be fun. I should wear that to my friend's wedding. I did not feel comfortable. Once I got there, I realized I was a bit of an ass. So I can only imagine what it would be like to be dressed like a postal worker. Because, you know, I walked in full Scottish attire, and, you know, people were just looking at me like, wow, glad to see you're taking Mark's wedding really seriously here.
Well, the problem is you didn't have bagpipes.
Yeah, yeah.
If you had played the wedding processional in bagpipes, that would have you would have been fine.
Yeah, and sort of work the perimeter.
Yes, exactly. What, Dave? Do you write about your most depressing day in your book, or no? You don't have depressing days, do you?
Wait, what did you say?
In your book, it's a series of vignettes. Anything that was particularly depressing that you wrote about in the book?
Yeah, I mean, this is not a spoiler, but you know, I write about my mom dying. The end of the book is about that, but that's really depressing.
Yeah, I was going to say that's not even comedically depressing.
No. I should have answered this question differently instead of just torpedoing this whole thing by talking about my mom dying. Yeah, I mean, I worked at a homeless shelter, which I actually had a great time. I was just out of college, and it was horribly, looking back on it, it was horribly depressing, you know, because it was a homeless shelter on 108th in Amsterdam, and it was seniors, so everyone had to be over 55 to live there, so there was a guy, I don't require a profanity. I don't need to swear to say this, but there was like a guy who collected feces, literally feces of different species, and you would have to go in his room every night and say like, come on, hand it over. What do you got today? And you go through his bag, and you'd have bags of feces, human, dog, you know, whatever he could get his hands on, basically.
What was the theory behind that?
I don't know. The guy, you know, it was one of those things where he also had, like, these goggles, like magnifying goggles that he would wear. And he'd walk in, he'd be sitting there in his underwear with these goggles on. You'd have to get the feces, you know. It was like taking a chicken bone from a dog, you know. Like, you had to just kind of coax it away from him. There's no explaining to him why he shouldn't have these bags of feces in his room. And that was like pretty much every shift. I would do that. And there was another guy with scabies.
You got any happy stories in your book?
Well, you asked for depressing.
I know. And you know what? I realized that. Why am I doing that?
Yeah. Really? Yeah. Oh, there's lots of, I make out with some chicks in one chapter. I accidentally have lunch with a high-end prostitute and another one.
How do you accidentally have lunch with a high-end prostitute?
Here's what happened.
Was it Thomas Friedman?
It was Bruce J. Friedman. No, I don't know why. I just heard Friedman. I went with it. To my knowledge, Bruce J. Friedman, I has nothing to do with prostitution.
I don't even know who that is.
Oh, he wrote Heartbreak Kid.
The movie?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The original.
No,
the original.
Of course.
Drew Friedman's dad.
Oh, right. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm jumping all over here. Anyway, but yeah, what happened with the prostitute, it was on the internet. I was spending a quiet night at home alone. Well, just me and the internet. And clicking around one website, end up on another to another. And then finally end up on this website that specialized in photos of women in various states of undress. Mostly that state of undress that, you know, involves not really being dressed.
Right.
And this
no,
is
I understand
like,
what you're
saying. You know, naked chicks.
Right.
But it wasn't a porno website. It was just like naked ladies, which is an interest of mine. And
And so this is a few years ago, so MySpace was still thriving. So I had my MySpace page open, and there was this writing room. So I see this picture of this woman. She's gorgeous, like the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen in my whole life, at least as far as I was concerned, you know, that night. So I look her up on MySpace, not because I want to, like, contact her, but I just think, oh, I should probably be MySpace friends with her. You know how you, like, now, like, Facebook friend someone just because, you know, I don't know, releases some chemical from your brain or something?
Yeah, you know what I mean, I'm not big on Facebook, but, yeah, on Twitter to a certain extent, or maybe they're a good financial reporter. Either way, I understand what you're saying.
Exactly, yeah, like, you follow a good financial reporter, and you know, it tickles you in a way. And so I did this. I friended her. She ended up writing to me. And then I don't know if it was because through seeing my MySpace tweets, but somehow she became a fan of my comedy. And then eventually was say, hey, she was like, oh, I'm coming to New York. I want to come meet you. I want to come to see a show. She never came to a show. And then she's like, you know, I couldn't make it, but, you know, I'd love to meet you, have coffee or lunch or something. And normally, I'm sure you get this too, just strangers will write to you.
No.
Because, you know, you're in show business.
Never.
Yes, this month, I'm sure it happens. Always like, hey, Sam, I'm in town from the Catskills. Do you want to grab a salad? That sort of thing. That happens to you, right?
No.
Yes, you're lying to me.
I mean, it's happened. It happened once.
Yeah. Well, okay. So,
okay,
you know,
yeah, no, it's not that strange. Look, I worked with Marin, who I think is, you know, Marin is one of the, I mean, I think his whole career is based on that. I think he's personally met every single one of his fans.
Well, I usually, you know, I usually tell people, I'm like, oh, yeah, come to a show. Just because I think the odds of someone shooting me in the face at a show aren't as good.
Right, of course.
But invite them to my home or whatever.
Right. I mean, it's weird. But, they know you better than you know them, and you're not necessarily. I mean, I personally am not a very social person, so.
Well, I you know, if anyone wants to get together and talk about me to me, I'm inclined to say yes.
Yes.
But,
so wait. So this woman wants to meet with you for lunch, and you go.
Well, you broke up a second there.
This woman wanted to meet with you for lunch, and so you went.
Right, exactly. And but you know, meanwhile, I've seen her naked already many times on the internet. I'm an expert on what she looks like naked at this point. And it turns out she is. So I meet her, and I think it's going to be a prank. Like, I think it's going to be a bunch of my friends. You know, just I think it, I must. This must be some weird setup, but I'm like, well, I love a prank.
Right.
I love a good prank. So I can't lose. So I meet her at Corner Bistro, right here in town. And it turns out it's actually this woman. She's gorgeous. I wish I could say her name. People could look up, see who it is.
No, that's not appropriate.
It's not appropriate, but, it would really, it would blow your mind. I'll email you.
Okay.
If you want.
Yeah, then that'd be great.
Say no and nod over the phone that you really want me. Anyway, so I walk in, this gorgeous woman, and we're talking. She's talking about, you know, my comedy and videos she's seen and this and that. And I'm just like, go on. What else do you like about me? And it's going on for longer than this story even. And I'm like, what about you? And, you know, I see you have that website. And she's like, yeah, you know, I'm trying to get away from that nude modeling stuff. I'm trying to do, like, legitimate modeling now. And I'm like, oh, is that what brings you down? She's like, no, I have this other job. And I'm like, what's that? And she ignores it. And we get back to talking about me. And eventually, so I'm like, what was that job you mentioned? And she's like, oh, you know, I'm a businessman. Sometimes, you know, we'll need a date for lunch or dinner or something. And like, I'll just meet up with them, and I get paid $4,000.
Wow.
And I'm just, what? Yeah, and I'm like, whoa. And I don't know what to, you know, I just try to play dumb. I'm like, wow, that's the best job in the world, lady. And she's like, well, you know, it's sexual sometimes. And then it occurs to me, you know, Corner Bistro, the tables are very close. It's lunch, it's crowded. And I realized everyone can hear this conversation. And I'm like, wow, everyone at this restaurant thinks that I arranged to meet a prostitute for lunch. And then I'm, it occurs to me, I'm like, I did arrange to meet a prostitute for lunch. And then I'm like, oh man, this sucks. Like, she's going to proposition me, you know, and then I'm insulted. So I think, well, hope she thinks I'd pay for sex. But then I think, you know, then I'm flattered that she thinks I could afford the $4,000. So I was very conflicted, very conflicted. But as it turned out, you know, it ended up being strictly platonic. There was no propositioning. And we remain friends to this day.
Huh. I was going to say, I get the sense that your neurosis just basically turned her off.
Yeah, it probably did. You know, I don't radiate that sort of confidence.
Yeah.
That would be like, yeah, let's do that. But I really don't think that. I genuinely think that she weirdly was a prostitute who happened to be a big comedy fan.
Yeah, weirdly. Why not? That's your job. It doesn't, you know, you make some money on the side. I don't think that defines your existence, particularly, I mean, it may for, you know, to the extent that any other job does, but I don't know.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, she, you know, I feel like, you know, it's she's working for the weekend. Or whatever, maybe not that, you know, but she has outside interests.
Right, working on the weekend.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
$4,000.
Well, that was the thing. Like, she kept, you know, because I didn't want it to, oh, don't do that. But I felt like, you know, I should maybe, because she was saying she didn't really want to do it, but the money was so good. And I said, yeah, you might want to get out of that line of work. I imagine it kind of takes its toll after a while. So we kept in touch. She would come to New York and be like, hey, do you have any shows? And I'd tell her. She would never show up. And then I'd say, oh, what happened? She said, oh, you know how it is.
Right.
I have that job and phone rings. I got to go. So she'd never come to show. So I didn't see her again, but she would, you know, she would write and stuff. And then like a couple weeks ago, she said, hey, I'm in town. I want to have lunch. I want to talk to you. So
she's pissed about the book.
No, it was before the book came out.
Okay.
So she wasn't hip to it yet. And then we have lunch. She's like, hey, the reason I wanted to talk to you is that, like, I stopped doing that. I don't do that anymore. And I started my own business. And she has like her own, retail business that does not involve having sex for money at all. And she was like, I want to tell you because I thought you'd be so proud of me. And I was like, yeah. And she's like, oh, I thought you would be so much more excited. And I was trying to be, I was, you know, happy for her, but I didn't want to make her think like, oh, I thought it was so awful what she was doing before. So I was trying to play it cool. But anyway, I'm happy she's...
And now she's able, theoretically, to come to your shows, or maybe you're starting to realize, like, no, she didn't want to see the comedy. She just wanted to hang out and have lunch with you.
No, I feel like, you know, I feel like she might come to a show now. I feel like this is going to work out.
Wow, this is... So this story is developing, as we say, in the news business.
Yes. There will be breaking news soon. No, I think we'll just remain friends.
Beautiful.
In
well,
fact, I can say with confidence that will be the case.
All right, so you still owe me a movie review, buddy, a recommendation. What should I watch on Netflix or Amazon? What should I watch on Amazon or Netflix?
Okay, I got one teed up for you. This is what I want to tell you last week, but you know, the technology wasn't there. I was going in and out of consciousness.
I understand.
But what I want to tell you to watch is this movie called The Great Happiness Space on Netflix.
Mm.
And it's about, I didn't intentionally tie this into my future bestseller, Tasteful Nudes, but I went, one of the chapters in the book is about, my rock band's tour in Japan. And it's about that whole
scene
thing. that whole wild scene and some of the cats we ran into.
Oh, so it's a documentary on your band?
No. While we were on tour in Japan, I kept seeing these. They have these clubs, and in the front there's all these framed pictures of these young Japanese guys with like spray tans and Bon Jovi hair and like frosted tips, and they like these tight like silk suits and stuff, like very like, and you know, pretty boys. And I made no sense to me what this was, because it didn't look like a gay club. It just looked like I don't know what was going on. And finally I asked our tour manager, I've seen it everywhere, and he's like, oh, those are boys clubs. And I'm like, what is that? Is it a gay bar? I'm like, no, it's this business. And I looked it up. These host bars, it's kind of like male geishas, where you go. It's something that never exists in America. It's you go, and women go there, and they pay to have these like young, pretty boys talk to them and hang out with them and flirt with them and talk about how they would really like to date them, but they're not ready yet, and just like laugh at their jokes, and it's this whole bizarre scene. So it's this documentary about this whole this great happiness space.
Oh, that's cool.
It's about it's really fascinating. And these women spend thousands of, like, tons and tons of money, thousands of dollars at these places. And you think, like, who are these women? Why? Apparently in the culture in Japan, like, it's very common. Like, men don't talk to women. Like, they don't sit and ask them how their day was and things. I don't think, you know, across the board, not every man. But I think it's
that sounds
culturally
like my house.
Common. Yeah, basically. It's like a night at the theater house.
Everybody just sits in silence.
Yeah, exactly. So these women will pay to have these attractive young men hang on their every word. And there's these whole rituals where they pour them champagne, and the women drink the champagne, and they're supposed to pretend like they've never had champagne out of a champagne glass, and they're awful. Wow. You know, it's spilling. They don't even know how to do it. They're giggling.
All right. So well, it's the great happiness space.
I'm going. I'm too much detail. Anyway.
I'm going to check it out. I don't want to ruin the movie.
You find out who these. Yeah. But you should watch it, and then it'll blow your mind when you find out who these women are at the end. You're like, oh, man.
All right. Well, don't.
I'm not going to spoil it for you.
Don't be a spoiler. Dave Hill, folks, the book is Tasteful Nudes. We have a link on our site at majority.fm for you to get this book.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, just based on the cover alone, I would get it. So tasteful.
Yeah. That was, you know, we had a lot of meetings about that. Just nailing it.
Believe me. Dave Hill, ladies and gentlemen, thanks, Dave. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks. That is the lesser half of our program today. Oh, went a little long. What are you going to do? Join me in the better half. You can call in at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, or IM me at Majority FM. We may talk about this Scott Walker case. I get a couple emails to read. And New York bans big Slurpees. Big Slurpees. We'll be right back after this. Don't forget, become a member. I don't know what to say. Become a member. See you in the better half.
Also, iTunes, donate your account, you know, all that good stuff.
Yes, thank you, Matt. Do it, folks. Just, you know what to do. Just do it. Come on. Pick yourself up by your bootstraps.